This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is Thanksgiving week, and we are thankful to present you this special episode of Left, Right, and Center, zooming out to examine some of the broad political trends that are shaping the 2020 election and beyond. On today's show, Davin Phoenix from UC Irvine will join me to talk about the anger gap. We'll discuss why anger is such an effective emotion for motivating political action, and why whites in America are more easily able to use it than blacks. We'll also talk about how the anger gap is shaping the 2020 race, and why Joe Biden's optimistic messages that draw some mockery in the progressive commentariat are so far connecting with black voters. Later, I'll be joined by two top national political reporters, Charlotte Alter from Time Magazine and Ested Herndon from the New York Times. They'll tell me about Elizabeth Warren's courting of black progressive activists and her strategy to build the diverse coalition that would make it possible for her to win the Democratic nomination. We will also talk about the tension of Iowa and New Hampshire, two very white states shaping the nominating race in an increasingly diverse political party. But first, here is my conversation with Laura Putnam, history professor at the University of Pittsburgh. Laura writes on the rise of resistance groups in the wake of the 2016 election and the increased political activation of college-educated, middle-aged suburban women. Their changing political behavior changed the political map in the 2018 midterms, helping Democrats flip many suburban districts where Republicans had long held majorities. We talked about why that happened and what it means for the upcoming election. Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
So I want to start with an article for Democracy Journal that you co-authored nearly 2 years ago now with Theda Scotchpole, who's a sociologist at Harvard. The article is about the changing political behavior of college-educated suburban women and how their ramped-up activism was reshaping the Democratic Party. You opened that article by saying that political news coverage sort of focuses excessively on progressive activism that tends to center in cities and on Donald Trump's success with whites in declining rural areas, and underemphasizes suburbs where half the country lives and where local activist groups, mostly led by women, have been the most prominent force in Democratic politics. And so before we look ahead to 2020, can you talk some about how that ended up shaking out in 2018? Did that activism feed into the big Democratic wins we saw in suburban congressional districts?
Absolutely. I mean, if you count up indicators of where the grassroots groups that were formed were strongest or sort of densest on the ground, there's every indication that it was precisely not at either end of the political spectrum. It wasn't at the congressional districts where Hillary Clinton did best, and it wasn't in the congressional districts where Hillary Clinton did worst. It was precisely in the middle, in the places where the Clinton-Trump vote in 2016 was most narrowly balanced. And those were exactly the congressional districts that in place after place, we saw those same individuals, those same grassroots organizers, recruit candidates, power forwards, fundraise, knock doors, and flip congressional seats from Republicans to Democrats in 2018.
So why there and why these specific demographic groups? I mean, why did college-educated suburban women become such an important activist force in the Democratic Party coalition?
So I think what's most important there is that college-educated suburban women step forward and change their level of activism. So I don't want to dismiss the importance of other kinds of ongoing activism within urban areas or among frontline communities, among communities of color. But there wasn't the kind of change in that. Those activist groups have been there, have been doing the work, calling for change for some time. It was really in the suburbs, especially among people who were likely Hillary Clinton supporters, relatively, you know, somewhere on the center to left spectrum in their own political beliefs, but hadn't been engaged in electoral politics, that's where we saw the change. And so, of course, that's what changes political equations. It's not just people still doing the same pushing that they have been doing, but when there's a radical shift among one demographic group.
So what sort of role have these activists and the groups that they've formed, how are they influencing the 2020 Democratic presidential primary?
I think the groups themselves, in case after case, are actually scrupulously staying out of the primary in any collective sense. So, and there's been some, you know, interesting reporting on differences of opinion, I would say, between the indivisible national leaders, for instance, who have been interested in the kinds of pressure that that activist groups can bring to bear through endorsements, for instance, and a lot of pushback from local leaders of grassroots groups, whether they're groups that are sort of associated with Indivisible or others, who really have seen how divisive the endorsement processes can be and who are really focused on building the broadest tent possible.
And so when you talk about, I mean, institutionally, these groups staying neutral, but they consist of individuals who I assume have preferences in this primary. And one thing, I mean, you mentioned obviously that this is a demographic group that has greatly changed its engagement. You have a lot of longstanding activism, especially in minority communities. And so when this group has sort of become more influential, presumably through its greater activism, it looks demographically quite a bit different from the Democratic Party coalition, Democratic Party primary electorate as a whole, right? I mean, we're not talking about entirely white people, but we're talking about a disproportionately white group of activists, a disproportionately educated group of activists. So, I mean, I would think one concern that one might raise would be that, you know, that this is a group that's going to sort of align toward different candidates in this primary than the Democratic primary electorate as a whole. Is that something that these activists are cognizant of, trying to adjust for?
I think they are aware of, they're much more self-aware and much more aware of the range of views surrounding them than many people who, let's say, the folks who put the same amount of hours into politics but do it through obsessively looking at Facebook feeds or Twitter feeds are much less attuned to the actual views of real live voters out there than folks who spent literally 20 hours a week for the last two electoral cycles. And not just the congressional cycle in 2018, but also working on local and county and municipal level elections in 2017 and 2019. These are folks who have conversations with voters who aren't like them all the time. And as a result, they are the most pragmatic, passionate political volunteers that you will meet. So while their own views started off being generally in the sort of center to left, and if anything, maybe their own views have moved slightly more to the left over the course of being very engaged in politics, they're also deeply aware of how unusual those views are among the wide spectrum of different, you know, ways of experiencing politics that they see all around them. You know, real human beings, which is probably, you know, not you or me, or maybe even, with all due respect, you know, most folks who are listening to this podcast may be unusually engaged in thinking about politics and thinking about political parties compared to the broad American electorate. Most people in this country, my impression is, when you have enough conversations, people have a clearer sense of whether they're a cat person and or a dog person and why, then they could articulate for you why they would want to be a Democrat or want to be a Republican. And, you know, that's a completely rational way to feel. I, having knocked a bunch of doors myself, you come to see that as an absolutely reasonable way to experience the world.
So would you say then that there's this sort of idea out there in the media that as this primary has shaped up, that there's pressure from an ideologically pure activist base, moving the party to the left, moving candidates to take litmus test positions on a variety of issues? You don't see that as coming from the activist base that you're actually seeing on the ground?
I don't see that as coming from the post-16 grassroots activist base. So, and that's part of what you're pointing to, is that there are multiple different activist bases within the Democratic Party, which is, you know, in the long run, all to the good. But it is a problem when some people cue on certain voices and assume that those are representative of the full range of hands-on, face-to-face volunteers out there, when there's actually a wide variety of political views and experiences and perspectives among the actual existing door-knocking activist base.
Can we talk a little bit about the role that the grassroots organizing activist base is likely to play in a general election this year? Obviously, that base will no longer be neutral by the time that we're in a general election. You've written about some difficulty that the Democratic Party has had in the past sort of maintaining this activism from election cycle to election cycle, and ways that the Democratic Party apparatus has sometimes sort of negatively gotten itself involved in a way that has turned off some people. Are they doing well at fostering these groups and letting them grow and be independent in the ways that makes them self-sustaining?
In general, there's a wide range of experience out there. There are communities within which grassroots groups have been able to work really smoothly with the local Democratic Party. Ironically, that's often some of the rural areas which voted heavily as a whole for Donald Trump and which are not going to be flipping back in a major way. Often those places, the local Democratic Committee either had come to not even exist as a party committee and now has been completely repopulated by new post-16 grassroots volunteers, or the local Democratic Committee was made up of a few lonely, stalwart souls who were really excited to welcome in the new energy. The places where the relationship between the new grassroots and the local Democratic Party has been more conflictive is, on the one hand, in big city areas where the local Democratic machine has been very focused on maintaining control over endorsements and, you know, sort of functioning in a patronage way with real material goods at stake, and maybe has not been responsive to a wide array of voices, actually to the left of the local Democratic Party machine. In those places, you've seen conflicts, whether that's happening in, you know, that same story in one way or another has played out in New York City, it's played out in Queens, it's played out in Philadelphia, it's played out in Pittsburgh. The other kind of place, and that's probably, you know, all to the good, although it's not, you know, from the point of view of the Democratic Party insiders at that municipal level or at that city level, their position is less solid than it was. But the folks who are organizing and mobilizing for greater grassroots engagement and transparency are doing things like registering voters and pulling people into vote in off-year elections at a pace that hadn't been seen in recent memory. So in terms of the party as a whole, rather than the individual stakeholders locally, that's probably a good thing, although it's uncomfortable for some people.
And so one thing you're referring to there is that, you know, a lot of these people, as they've become more politically active, one way they've done that is by actually becoming local Democratic Party officials. And so what is, you know, as people think about engaging in political activism, obviously you can do that through a political party or not. What is the importance of people who are trying to be active within Democratic politics of actually becoming part of the party apparatus? How does that make you more effective?
A lot of grassroots activists, very quickly, within their first 6 or 12 months of being involved, these sort of post-November 2016 activists, recognized that there were certain pinch points or bottlenecks within the political process where being an insider mattered, even if being an insider means being a duly elected precinct person by having gotten, you know, 11 write-in votes from your precinct in which is literally, in most places within Pennsylvania, at least, that's the cutoff. If no one is running, you get your 11 write-in votes, and you're in. And you are, so in some sense, you're a Democratic Party official at that point.
Wow. One thing that is preoccupying Democratic primary voters is who is most likely to beat Donald Trump if nominated. Unfortunately, it's kind of difficult to figure out the answer to that question a year ahead of an election. The New York Times has done some interesting polling recently in battleground states, including Pennsylvania. And part of what they've done with that is try to look at, you know, what are persuadable voters like? The sort of voters who say, you know, that they think they might vote for Biden over Trump, but they would vote for Trump over Elizabeth Warren. And one of the groups that the Times identified as being overrepresented among those persuadable voters are upper middle class suburbanites in suburban areas that have been trending toward the Democratic Party who express ideological objections to Elizabeth Warren, who say they don't like single payer, say they think she's too far to the left, that sort of thing. I've been wondering what sort of role these activist groups and this increased political engagement among suburban women would play in a general election like that. Some of these areas where that polling might indicate toward Warren having specific weaknesses as a candidate might also be areas where these groups would have the greatest strength on the ground. I'm wondering if that's a significant countervailing factor as the Democratic Party sort of tries to sell voters on a candidate who might have, you know, particular geographic weaknesses.
I think that's a really important point. The grassroots groups that that we've been researching and that I've been describing are absolutely most prevalent in places like sort of the upscale inner, you know, relatively cosmopolitan upscale suburbs and sort of the inner suburbs, and also just outside of that in more ex-urban areas, so places that had been the classic sort of centerpiece of country club Republicans. And so it's for sure it's the case that if Elizabeth Warren is the nominee, that she will be able to rely on a bunch of impassioned local interlocutors in those places, you know, making the case for her. It's the sort of flip side or the other dimension of that is that some of the places where the grassroots groups are, although present in but in smaller numbers, are the kind of Obama-Trump districts or Obama-Trump counties that commentators have also been focusing on as an important potential target or an area that some people think may be potentially persuadable by the right candidate or by a Democratic candidate in 2020. Those are places the sort of more hard-hit former industrial areas are places where there's a much less pervasive presence of new grassroots groups. and where those grassroots activists who are there don't necessarily look a lot like in terms of their networks, in terms of their own social position, their own demographic indicators and so on. They don't necessarily look a lot like those potential Obama-Trump voters mm-hmm. around them. So it's a little bit of an open question how effective they can or cannot be in bridging that divide. The one thing that all grassroots groups and all grassroots activists, you know, who we're talking with are clear on is that no matter who the Democratic nominee is, they're going to go all out in supporting them. So again, there's a sort of core pragmatism there that's going to be brought to bear, you know, whatever their personal feelings about whoever the volunteer, whoever the nominee is.
Laura Putnam is a professor and chair of the history department at the University of Pittsburgh. Laura, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Josh. It's been great talking.
That was my conversation with Laura Putnam, history professor at the University of Pittsburgh. I will be back with political scientist Davin Phoenix to talk about the anger gap. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. Now we're going to talk about the role of anger in the 2020 campaign. My guest for this conversation is Davin Phoenix. Davin is an assistant professor of political science at UC Irvine, where he studies topics including black politics, public opinion, and political communication. His forthcoming book is called The Anger Gap: How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. Welcome, Davin.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to get to your book thesis in a moment about why white Americans, both white Republicans and white Democrats, have been more able to harness the political power of anger than black Americans. But can we first talk about why anger is such a powerful force in politics? What's special about anger in terms of motivating voters?
Sure. Well, when we think about anger as an emotion state distinct from other negative emotion states in response to stressors or threats, we can consider some distinct characteristics that make it an action-ready feeling. When you are angry about something, you feel a sense of slight, right? You aren't just frustrated. Something happened that was a violation of a norm, and you feel great propulsion to right that wrong. And so when you're feeling angry, again, as opposed to frustrated or scared or even sad, you have increased impulsivity, you have less of a sense of risk aversion, and you're actually more prone to be more confident in your actions and less questioning of your actions. And so it's just a very action-ready state. And so when we think about the political arena, when we see people be angry, they are not only more likely to take up costly actions, they're also more likely to have a bit of a tribal mentality and support their teams. That can be very powerful for partisans looking to mobilize the base.
So I would tend to assume that it would be easier for a party that's out of power to draw upon anger to motivate its voters than a party in power. Is that true? And has Donald Trump found a way to turn that on its head, finding a way to use anger to mobilize people even when he's already in charge of the government?
Yes. So generally, and based on my research looking at some survey data from the American National Election Study, I do find that the party out of power is looking to harness anger and leverage it even more effectively, because it's easier to make the threat to the party base more salient. They already see what they're missing out on because they are out of power. And so you can simply crystallize what they have stood to lose from the existing regime and mobilize them on the basis of, hey, we can't have this continued state of dissatisfaction, right? You've got to be mobilized and angry about against this. So I don't think Donald Trump is necessarily distinct from past Republican regimes in finding a way to successfully cultivate anger amongst the Republican base, even when they do control power, not just at the national level, but increasingly at the state level as well. And so we can think about the kind of messaging that the Republican Party can utilize and the ways in which they can make a group of people that, in terms of institutional representation, are empowered, feel like they are threatened or feel like they are being slighted by all of these different perhaps symbolic or gestural kind of indicators that they're losing out. So we can think about all of that rhetoric of the disaffected, particularly kind of disaffected white males or disaffected folks in rural communities, disaffected folks in middle America or the quote unquote real America. Donald Trump was very kind of extreme in utilizing and weaponizing that kind of rhetoric, but he did not create that playbook. We can think about, you know, past Republican elites solidifying that playbook and him kind of taking it to another level.
So what leads to an anger gap between black voters and white voters?
Yeah, so I'm identifying a couple of factors when I see kind of across these different political eras, two kind of consistent trends. One, African-Americans expressing less anger than their white counterparts over the same objects of anger or over the same perspective threats. And also anger being a much weaker mobilizer of political action, especially electoral actions for African-Americans relative to whites. And so I think there's a couple of factors going on there. One, we have to think about the potential costs to African-Americans individually, collectively, of expressing that anger. We can think about the very real archetype or stereotype of the angry black man, angry black woman, and the ways in which that invokes social or political or potential legal costs on African-Americans. To what degree is there greater scrutiny or pushback if we show a level of emotional dissatisfaction with politics? We can also think about anger differences being rooted in very different sets of expectation and entitlement. So as I mentioned, you only get angry when you feel that some kind of norm has been violated, when you feel you've been denied something you rightfully deserve or that you rightfully expect. So you have to consider the greatly diminished or tempered expectations that many African Americans generally carry towards politics, that they don't expect the same kind of equitable treatment because of a structural view of politics that indicates, right, that black people are kind of marginalized within politics, then something that comes along within the political environment that white folks might respond to as, you know, something that's unacceptable, that engenders a sense of indignation, African Americans could look at that same thing and say, well, that's just an everyday part of life for me, right? That's something that I expect from a system that I don't necessarily think is operating freely and fairly. So those kinds of dynamics are working, I think, to reinforce one another to create this kind of anger gap. Whereas, you know, you look at the political landscape and you look at all these things that could be particular stressors for African Americans, they don't respond with anger. They don't respond with those kind of clenched fists and flared nostrils. They say, okay, how can we kind of persevere in the midst of this, right? How can we push through this? But I'm not going to let you see me angry.
It's interesting. You talk in the book, I mean, because when you talk about the utility of anger as a motivating tool for white voters, you're not just talking about conservative or Republican whites. You talk about a distinction between how black Democrats and white Democrats reacted to the election of Donald Trump, with, you know, a lot more surprise and anger among whites and a sort of more expectation and resignation among black Democrats. And so I guess that's partly about a sense of entitlement, you would say, but also partly about just, you know, a greater sense that, you know, the political system was supposed to work and was expected to work in a certain way, and then it didn't.
That's exactly right. And that's what I'm thinking about when I speak about entitlement, right? Not in the sense of we demand these particular services and benefits, right? But having entitlement to a kind of a totally transparent and free and fair and responsive system, right? Generally, African-Americans don't carry that same level of political trust. And if you don't have that trust, right, you can't be as moved or as phased when you see outcomes that you feel are sketchy or, you know, not expected.
And so how is this playing out post-2016? I mean, one thing earlier in the show, we spoke with Laura Putnam, who's a history professor at the University of Pittsburgh, about the rise of resistance political groups, especially in the suburbs, especially among college-educated white women who've had a big change in their level of political activism following the 2016 election. In 2016, there was somewhat of a drop-off in African-American turnout compared to the previous two elections where Barack Obama had been on the ballot. What is the indication of how black responses to the Trump administration are playing out in terms of political engagement, both that we saw in the midterms and that we're seeing going into the 2020 election?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the key question, right? So I think this era of resistance is really critical for understanding the kind of racial differences and which emotions mobilize groups. So what I find, in addition to the anger gap, is that African-Americans are generally more mobilized by positive emotions such as hope and pride. And so we did. So I think that maps with our understanding of black patterns of turnout, even in presidential elections. When we look at the surge in black turnout for Obama in 2008 and 2012, that's not just about descriptive representation, right? I think that's also about the incredible resonance and salience of his messaging, which we first heard from Jesse Jackson's primary campaigns in 84 and 88. You know, keeping hope alive and yes, we can, and change. I think these are very mobilizing messages because they resonate with the ways in which black people look to navigate a racially stressful environment. And I think they have a resonance with the ethos of the black Christian church as well. And so when we look at the era or the kind of state of black mobilization and resistance, we have to look beyond the mobilizing power of the threat of four more years of this existing regime. Black people on the ground, I think particularly in the 2018 midterms, were mobilized by a mix of dissatisfaction with the status quo and also very clear and resonant signals they got of responsiveness from Democratic operatives on the ground. And so we can think at the statewide level, even if they didn't win elections, the candidates for governor in Florida and Georgia, how they were able to strike a responsive chord, not just with black voters, right, but with a multiracial Democratic base. They weren't simply talking about resistance. They weren't simply talking about mobilizing the base in anger over the status quo, right? They're also offering a very clear and concretely drawn contrast between that status quo that can give people something to hope for in addition to something to kind of rally against. And so I think that's interesting and indicative of a potential playbook for the Democratic candidates at the national level for the presidency and at the statewide level and even at the level of Congress going forward. How do you find that balance between identifying the things that your base is rightfully grieved about, but also recognizing those intra-group differences in what is going to strike the most responsive chord? The Democratic side has a much more uphill battle because they have a much more racially diverse base than the Republican Party, which by virtue of being so racially homogenous, can rely on the same type of messaging to mobilize anger that's going to be leveraged so effectively by its base.
What is the interplay between what you described there in terms of the power of messages about hope and optimism with black voters, but then also you talk about resignation among black voters? I mean, aren't those in tension? How are messages of hope so effective with a group that you describe as having a tendency toward resignation because of, you know, so much disappointment in the history of American politics?
Yes. So I think the dynamic at work here is that the resignation is essentially a self-preservation mechanic. So if you are encountering a political environment and looking at that environment through a racialized lens that stresses that this system is not responsive to your group's collective demands or concerns, then when you encounter those kinds of threats or those kinds of confirmations of that belief and understanding, it's exhausting. Right. And it's stressful and it can be alienating. And so rather than respond with an indignation or even an anxiety about each of those indicators or confirmations, you respond by saying, you know what, I'm going to let this light off my back. I'm going to get together with my group and we're going to commiserate. We're going to laugh this off. I think that's what the resignation is doing. Right. It's kind of giving you an outlet for processing these disappointments. So at the same time, when you're encountering that rare perspective opportunity or that reason for hope, that can be particularly powerful for you because of how it doesn't square, right, or cohere with what you expect. And so oftentimes when we're thinking about the power of threats to move people, we're kind of considering those threats as rare or unique to someone, right? Because they're generally satisfied with how things are going, and then that threat is imposed, and that motivates a very distinct response. We can think about fight or flight, right? I'm kind of arguing that there's a unique dynamic for African Americans where that opportunity represents the departure from the status quo as opposed to the threat, which is the status quo.
What do you make of Joe Biden's strong appeal to black voters in this primary in that context? Because one knock I see a lot on Joe Biden from progressives, not just white progressives, but I guess mostly from white progressives, is sort of saying that he's naively optimistic about certain things, that, you know, he says that he's going to go in there and he's going to be able to work with Republicans and achieve things with a Congress that Barack Obama couldn't necessarily. And that is criticized as being a sort of excessively optimistic about his chances about what he can do, but it seems that his messaging is connecting very well with black voters, or at least significantly better with black voters than it is with white voters.
Yes, I think there is something resonant about that kind of optimistic messaging, particularly because it's not an optimism that seems so beyond the pale, right? So African Americans' resignation does generally lead to a sense of tempered expectations. And so if you are promising the stars and the moon, that is not the kind of hope cue that's going to effectively mobilize the group, right? This is a group that is very much quite pragmatic. And so I think the large support for Biden at this process, or at this time, which is still very early, right, in the process, I think is largely indicative of that black pragmatism. It's not just Biden's connection to Obama, which certainly doesn't hurt him amongst many voters, particularly potentially older voters, but also the fact that it's like the devil you know, right? So Biden being on the political map for so long gives him an added layer of credibility. That's not something that the other candidates can't overturn or overcome. We still have a ways to go. But I think that's largely the reason we've seen such staunch support of African-Americans for Biden. It's very similar to the dynamic we witnessed in 2008, when despite the calls of pundits, African-Americans weren't moving wholesale to Barack Obama until he established himself, particularly with his strong showing in Iowa, as a truly viable candidate. Right up to that point, support had been quite staunch for Hillary Clinton, and that's because of that built-in credibility based on the long-term association that the Clintons had with black voters. So I think that's what we're seeing there with support for Biden.
And that's something you hear from basically all the Democratic campaigns that aren't the Biden campaign, is say, you know, look at 2008 and look how black support in South Carolina turned so much after the Iowa result. But it seems to me like the likeliest thing if Biden doesn't win Iowa is that some other white candidate is going to win Iowa, maybe Elizabeth Warren, conceivably Bernie Sanders. And a lot of the polling I've seen has, you know, the top three candidates with black voters all being white candidates. What do you make of the lack of black support, at least so far, for black candidates in this race? And then also, is someone like Elizabeth Warren in a position to take an Iowa win and take that to black voters in South Carolina? I mean, obviously, she's not going to have the same pitch that Barack Obama could have had in 2008, that he was going to be the first black president. Are black voters in South Carolina waiting for Elizabeth Warren to show that she can win Iowa?
It's certainly plausible. So in thinking about the maybe lack of robust support for Booker and Harris, I think it's very instructive in thinking about black voters as being much more strategic and varied than oftentimes the discussion implies. Descriptive representation is simply not enough. There is a looking at all of the kind of facts of the record that can be gleaned. And so Kamala Harris, I think particularly amongst younger generations of black voters, might face added scrutiny, right, because of her past career in law enforcement and as a prosecutor and kind of in the carceral wing of government. And Cory Booker has similar questions about the ways in which his rise and ascension in politics coming to New Jersey, right, came at the expense of the kind of old guard of black politics represented in Sharp James, and the ways in which he might not be viewed as carrying the baton of the civil rights generation, which is very much still revered as black people are thinking about politics, right, but kind of cut against it, right, and kind of pushed against it in the way that he might still be struggling to overcome. There's also questions about credibility that both of these candidates still have time to address. But I think that's why we're not seeing that robust support, because there's kind of these, not red flags, but lingering questions that haven't been totally ironed out. The question of someone like Elizabeth Warren being positioned to receive that kind of black support after a strong showing, I think that's very much in play. You know, Elizabeth Warren has had some real strides in making concrete, clear overtures to the black community. I think about the ways in which she spoke specifically about black women and black women's issues and access to health when she spoke at a black women's forum a few months back. There's also been some pitfalls, right? So I think there's a struggle when she has trouble identifying black individuals she would name to her cabinet. You know, black people are very aware of the power of those kinds of cues and signals as indicators, right, of how much attention a candidate is going to give to their precise and distinct needs. But given that, Elizabeth Warren has made clear strides, not just to talk about concrete issues in a way that I think does evoke maybe both the sense of optimism and hope and potentially pride, in addition to kind of a recognition of things that are wrong or a sense of indignation. But she's also made some concrete strides to signal directly to black voters. And that's, like any other kind of relevant group in politics, what black voters are seeking.
Davin Phoenix is assistant professor of political science at UC Irvine, where he studies topics including black politics, public opinion, and political communication. His forthcoming book is called The Anger Gap: How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. Davin, thank you for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was my conversation with Davin Phoenix, assistant professor of political science at UC Irvine. I will be back with Charlotte Alter of Time Magazine and Estelle Herndon from the New York Times to talk about how all of this is playing out in the 2020 nominating campaign. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow, and I'm joined now by two political reporters on the trail covering the 2020 presidential campaign. Estelle Herndon is national politics reporter for the New York Times, and Charlotte Alter is national correspondent at Time Magazine. Hello.
Hey.
Hey, thanks so much for having us.
Absolutely. One of the things I was just discussing with Davin Phoenix was some inroads that Elizabeth Warren has been working to make with black voters in this campaign. Obviously, Joe Biden has been the front runner in general, has been well out in front in terms of black support. But Elizabeth Warren has made some inroads with black voters, and particularly, it sounds like, a lot of inroads with black progressive activists. And so, Estelle, could you talk about this event that Warren recently had down in Atlanta with black women political activists and with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, one member of the squad from Massachusetts who has endorsed her, and what you sort of see there in terms of Elizabeth Warren's strategy to try to break into that wall that people perceive Joe Biden as having with black voters?
Yeah, I think the event was an important one to kind of understand what Warren's trying to do here. I think it starts actually at the New York event she had, which was kind of her biggest campaign rally yet. And she used the story of the shirtwaist fire to talk about women's role in labor movements. And one of the things that was coming out of that, and I know the campaign was thinking about, was how to make sure it's a racially diverse movement that they're talking about, not just the kind of white suffragists, but also black and brown women who contributed to those movements also. And so they viewed this speech as Atlanta as kind of a sequel to that. And it was a similar type of event, another kind of stage set piece that we see from her that's kind of rare. And so I think it requires some examination. They were at Clark Atlanta University, the HBCU in Atlanta, all women's college. And it was a packed house. And she gave another similar historical speech. This was about the Atlanta washerwomen who went on strike and formed a kind of Washerwomen Society, but again, telling a story about how black women's contributions to the labor movement plays a key role in what she views as the resurgence of progressive activism. And I think the political message there was, I recognize that race has a specific role in the kind of progressive landscape. And so there was one line she said, don't talk about race neutral policies anymore. I think she's trying to say that I don't have the kind of blind spots that some have accused other leftists of having. I think that race is a unique factor here, and we need government programs that specifically target racial injustices, and using her support from her black surrogates and also history to tell that message.
And this has been part of a broader strategy for her in the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that I've heard from really high-profile black women progressive activists is that when they call the Warren campaign answers the phone, they want to hear their concerns, and they feel heard, essentially. And I think it's part of, I mean, if you look at Warren's strategy with calling up her small grassroots donors, you know, she releases those videos where she's like, hey, it's Elizabeth Warren, and it's a teacher on the other line or an ordinary person who's been supporting her campaign. This is all part of a strategy of personal outreach and accountability that she's trying to present herself as having to ordinary Americans. And I think she's been especially proactive about doing that with black progressive organizers. I've talked to many, many of these organizers who say that they're undecided. There are a lot of candidates who are interesting to them, but they've been particularly impressed by Warren's ability to reach out to them, sit down, hear their concerns, come back with a policy that reflects their conversation, follow up, and it's not always mediated by staff.
And so what is the role of organized black progressive activists in terms of as an inroad into the black electorate more broadly? Because, I mean, so far, obviously, Joe Biden is still way ahead of Warren in the polls with black voters. Black Democrats are more likely than white Democrats to describe themselves to pollsters as moderate or conservative. White Democrats are a lot more likely to say that they're liberal or very liberal. So is this a strategy to get ahead of Joe Biden, or does this get you sort of one slice of the black electorate that may not be representative of the broader black electorate?
I think it's a slice. I think she's got to start somewhere, and where she's starting is the people who are kind of ideologically on her side. Mm-hmm. But let's remember that even in the last election, Bernie Sanders, who had the ideological similarities with many of these people, was not able to consolidate that support quickly because of these kind of, like Charlotte saying, there wasn't the kind of communication. You hear activists saying they did not feel particularly hurt. There was no protest against Sanders at the time, and they did not feel like there was an open dialogue about criminal justice. Warren has made this a linchpin. I mean, even if we date back before this campaign, in the last year, in the run-up to her announcement, she has by far been the most aggressive into reaching out to the black left, which I will, again, separate from black electorate. This is the black progressive side where it wasn't a one-to-one that she was definitely going to be their type of candidate, but she has been someone who has infused her policies with the kind of messages they want and been an open book to them. I think she thinks of that as a start for, or a kind of energetic start for the black electorate as a whole, which, as you mentioned, is more moderate, is more religious, is in the kind of Joe Biden home.
And on that note, and Estad has done some really great reporting on this, for the last three elections, we've seen black voters largely vote as a block for Obama twice and then for Clinton. And one of the things that's really interesting about this race is that you have a vice president to a popular black president. You have two really compelling black candidates. You have Bernie Sanders, who has really high name recognition. You have Elizabeth Warren, who's been making really effective outreach into the community. And so we may not see black voters vote with one candidate this time. It seems very likely that there will be a splintering across other lines, and this election will essentially be decided by how that splinters, because there was an analysis by NBC News, which I thought was really interesting, that basically said that if current trends continue, one in four ballots cast in the Democratic primary will be cast by black voters. So black voters will decide this election. And the question is, who is getting their support and how much and why?
Well, but if the black vote fragments like that, then maybe black voters won't decide the election,
That's a great point. I think that part of the power has always been the black electorate picking one candidate, as Charlotte mentions. I don't think anyone in the Warren Sanders world thinks they're going to put up Obama-esque numbers with black people. What they do need to win, though, is for Joe Biden to kind of come down to earth.
That's funny about waiting for Joe Biden to come down to earth. I feel like that's everybody's strategy in a number of ways. I mean, it's Mike Bloomberg's strategy. Like, why is he getting in this race? Because it's sort of an assumption that Joe Biden has to fall apart at some point. When can we expect Joe Biden to come down to earth? I mean, I feel like I keep hearing people say it's early, it's early, it's early, it's early. It's not that early anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's tricky. I don't hear a ton of enthusiasm for Joe Biden out on the trail. I think another really important thing to consider is the disparity between opinions of, like, people who think and care about politics and are following it all the time, like the three of us, versus a lot of ordinary people who maybe are going to be tuning in 2 weeks before they vote, a week before they vote. And right now, Joe Biden is the person that they've heard of and that they're the most familiar with.
Although that's funny, because Matt Iglesias was tweeting about this a couple of weeks ago. I think it was a Quinnipiac poll he was pointing to, that, like, Joe Biden actually does better with voters who say they're paying a lot of attention than with voters who say they're not. It's Bernie Sanders who overindexes with people who say they're not paying a lot of attention. And so I think, you know, I think there's been a huge disconnect between sort of the media and political class, where candidates who do well with college-educated voters, especially college-educated white voters. So, you know, we're looking at Elizabeth Warren, to some extent Mayor Pete, sort of get overinflated in terms of their chances. And then there's not enough discussion of Biden. I also feel like that Bernie Sanders, who I don't expect Bernie Sanders to win this nomination, but I feel like he's been sort of written off in a way that I find a little odd given where he is in the polls.
I mean, both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden think the people that are going to sweep them to the nomination are people in the blind spot of political media. And so I think that is a joint between them. But also, like, if that theory is right, then yeah. I mean, if Bernie Sanders is correct that there's a lot of people who are outside of this process who are going to get in because they believe in the Medicare for All movement, he's going to win. I mean, that's a very tall order, right? But, like, if that theory is correct, and if Joe Biden's theory is also that the Twitters of the world, the kind of activists of the world, when you go to these forums and he's being pressed about this answer and that answer and he doesn't respond in the right way, that that's not the electorate that's actually going to put him over the top. It's people who are sitting at their home scared about Donald Trump.
Estelle, you mentioned sort of the idea that one thing that might be an entry for other candidates is if the first early states weaken Joe Biden a little bit. And a reason they might do that is because the first two states that vote are much whiter than the country as a whole. The electorate there will be much whiter than Democratic primary electorate as a whole. What do people on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire have to say about that? Is there a recognition that this system where, you know, in a party where 40% of the electorate is not white, to have the first two contests in states where 90% of the electorate is white, that that's a problem in the long run?
I think it's – I would be interested to see what you say about this. I think it's been increasingly talked about as Mayor Pete has capitalized on it rather than when Elizabeth Warren was capitalizing on it 4 months ago. It's the same electorate that made Elizabeth Warren the co-frontrunner that has made Mayor Pete an early state frontrunner. It's that same white liberal college-educated voter. I think progressives are increasingly annoyed at that electorate once it provided a candidate who they don't really like. I also think that where the candidates have landed on it is by saying, oh, the first four states in combination give us a representative sample. But of course, that doesn't recognize the particular importance of those first two. When you're in the ground in Iowa, Katie Glick and Sydney had a great story on this. They know Joe Biden is not running as strong as other folks. I mean, that's kind of clear because of the way the caucuses are so much about organizing and about driving out your base. The question is whether he finishes in a place that messes up his support elsewhere. And I don't think anyone really knows exactly what that is. If he finishes third, is that enough? Does it have to be fourth or fifth? Does it depend on what the margins are and who finishes above him? I don't think we know those answers, but I don't think anyone expects in Iowa. I haven't heard much people talking about Joe Biden winning it.
Yeah, I also haven't heard that. I've heard, I have been surprised, frankly, by the tremendous enthusiasm that I've seen for Mayor Pete in Iowa. And what I found particularly interesting and bizarre was bizarre given how different they are politically from one another is how I would go around to Pete rallies in Iowa and ask people who they caucused for in 2016, and some of them would say Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. So it's like this – I think that to the question of Iowa and whether it's fair – I haven't heard a ton of soul searching from Iowa voters about whether this is fair. It's certainly a narrative that's been bubbling up in political media. I do think one of the things that people would say is that, listen, any Democrat who's going to win a general election is going to need to prove both their ability to assemble a diverse coalition and their ability to win over suburban white voters in places like Iowa, because that's what won Democrats the House of Representatives. And in some ways, the lessons of 2018 are almost the two big takeaway lessons of 2018 are almost divergent from one another, because on the one hand, you have the resurgence of the progressive left with people like AOC and the Squad elected and socialists elected in on city councils in various places and state legislatures. And then you also have sort of the actual path to victory for Democrats in that election went through a lot of these ex-urban and suburban districts that any Democratic nominee is going to need to win.
I mean, but that will require the candidates to say explicitly is that it is valuable to preference those white suburban Iowans, and they can't say that out loud.
Of course,
right?
Not.
And so, and so they're in this pickle where Elizabeth Warren is asked the question, and she says, "Oh, I'm just a player in the game," which is a very non-Elizabeth Warren answer.
Yeah,
because. Right. The politics of it are so toxic for them.
Well, and it's also like, you know, like to, kind of in defense of that answer, it's a little bit like, what's she going to do, bow out of the Iowa caucus? Like, unfortunately, that's the way that they've set it up this year. I mean, well, you're right. Maybe they all could bow out of the Iowa caucus, but that seems like it would be suicide.
I mean, the Castro answer is to say it's unfair, even while you go there.
Right.
Or to say that the first – I don't give – first states could vote – or the first four could vote at the same time. I don't know why anyone says that.
That is a good point. Really good point.
And look how the Castro answer worked for Julian Castro, though.
So, 100%. I think you could only say that answer if you're uninterested in winning Iowa, which is why the politics are so messy.
In terms of people this primary being a game of waiting for Joe Biden to stumble, is there an indication we should be watching for before – Iowa actually votes on February 3? Is that where the proof comes in that, like, if Biden is not able to improve his standing in Iowa and does not win that caucus, is that when it breaks through to the public and that's when the poll numbers move? Or can we say if Joe Biden is still well in the lead nationally on January 15th, can we call him the really serious frontrunner at that point?
It is my opinion that where Joe Biden finishes in Iowa is much more important than who wins. And I think that the number I'm looking for is if he drops from around the top pack in Iowa, which he currently is, to firmly outside. And I think if we're going into a final month before Iowa where he's looking more like fifth than third, that is a big indicator. I think if favorabilities among black voters are rising with other candidates, not necessarily that they're backing him in polling, but they like them, is another indicator I'm looking at. But some of it is just going to have to come on caucus day.
I think that Democrats love to fall in love. And also Democrats love surprises. And that's why, for example, people complain a lot, I think fairly, that Mayor Pete has gotten all this coverage. And I'm certainly somewhat responsible for that because I cover him, unfortunately.
I try not to talk too much about the Pete campaign because my husband is a professional fundraising operative and they're one of his clients. But I mean, isn't one of the key things there that, like, Pete says yes to media requests, and that's a big part of why he gets so much coverage?
Definitely. And also, he's a surprise. It's shocking. Who is this guy? Whoa, what? And somebody like Joe Biden, it's like, oh, Joe Biden's running for president? Like, what else is new? And so I think you're totally right about where Joe Biden finishes in Iowa. But what I've heard out on the trail, and this is true for, in particular, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, is that they have people who are with them but open to other options. They're with them, but they're not converts. They're with them, but they also kind of, somebody might be with Joe Biden, but they also want to hear what Kamala Harris is saying. And, oh, Cory Booker seems really interesting. They're with Bernie, but they kind of like what Elizabeth Warren has to say, too. And so I think that their support is softer than it appears in the polls right now, because they are both of those two candidates are I'm not really saying this in a particularly articulate way, but their supporters are open to other options in a way that, for example, some of the Warren diehards are kind of like with her till the end.
We're going to have to leave that there. I want to thank Charlotte Alter, national correspondent at Time Magazine, and Ested Herndon, national politics reporter at The New York Times. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
That's all we have time for this Thanksgiving week. I want to thank Davin Phoenix, Laura Putnam, Charlotte Alter, and Ested Herndon. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. Tadim Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.